This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates that relate to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing Tom Rogers. He's a Native American activist and an advocate for tribal issues in Washington, D.C. He does business as Carlisle Consulting. Rogers is an enrolled member of the Blackfeet Nation in Montana, where the Siksika language, he's called the one who rides his horse east. Tom was named by Politico magazine in 2023 as one of the top 40 most powerful and impactful people in the nation for his work on public policy that involves Native Americans and cannabis. He was the whistleblower of the largest congressional scandal in the last 100 years, the Jack Abramoff scandal. And he was acknowledged by both the Obama and Biden administrations as the best advocate and lobbyist for Native people in the nation. So, Tom, it's great to be talking with you today.
Great to be talking to you too, John, and also to all of your wonderful listeners.
So how are things in Washington?
Well, my friend, they are rainy, subtropical. We're getting... It's only fitting that we're talking about the environment today and by indirect reference, climate change, because we're having these incredible hurricanes and tropical storms working
right.
Their way up the coast. And so it's very fitting that we're having this conversation today.
So, Tom, tell us about your background how you got into lobbying there in Washington for Native American interests.
Well, I've been very fortunate, as you referenced, John. I'm a Blackfeet tribal member, enrolled member. My parents are from Browning, Montana. Proudly a Blackfeet tribal member. I grew up on the Great Plains of eastern Montana.
Uh-huh.
You referenced, went to school in Colorado, undergrad, law school, graduate law. Then I sold my 78 Z28 Camaro, John, to pay for my ticket out here to D.C. I'd never been east of Minneapolis, and clerked for the chief judge at the U.S. Tax Court, and then I applied for a position as Senator Max Baucus' tax counsel when he worked on the Senate Finance Committee.
Wow.
And I realized then when I was on staff that Native people deserved a larger audience and a breadth of work.
Uh-huh.
And I assisted with the senator to pass a number of laws to benefit Native Americans across the country. And then when I left the Hill, I made that my avocation and vocation. In fact, when I clerked for the chief judge of the tax court, him and I on our first court opinion disagreed.
Mm.
And he says, Tom, he said, you've got a heart, maybe too big of a heart. He said, there's the law and then there is the emotion behind it. And I told him I understood that, sir, but I felt that the IRS was overreaching. Well, he looked at me and he pointed to the U.S. Capitol, John.
Yeah.
And he said, Tom, if you have a problem with the way the law is codified now, then you need to go there and change the law.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I did.
So you represent several different tribes, is that right?
Oh, yeah, all across the country, from Connecticut to Florida to California to Montana.
Oh, wow.
All across the United States. I'm very fortunate, John. I have found my purpose in life, and in a large measure, it has saved me. I lost my partner of decades to pancreatic cancer and my mother to dementia.
Oh.
And so my work literally saved my life.
All right. So what's the range of issues that you deal with?
Oh, my God, John. I've done, for Native people, I've done anti-human trafficking, which is, you know, missing, murdered indigenous women. I have done opioid litigation, jewel vaping litigation, water rights, cannabis, tax laws, land into trust, very proudly voting rights. I do a lot of voting rights work, John. That has been one of my just godsends, creator sends that I have been able to work on. So if it involves Native people and, of course, in environmental issues, I work to protect grizzlies, bison, wolves, create a sanctuary for our Native brothers and sisters, which the wolves and the grizzlies and the bison are. I worked to change the name of a mountain, John, in Yellowstone Park.
Wow.
Led that effort. It was named previously, John, it was named after an individual named Gustavus Stone, who massacred 200 Blackfeet women and children on the Marias River.
Right.
And I was able, after 10 years, to get that name changed to First Peoples Mountain in Yellowstone Park.
So do tribal interests pretty much converge, or are there some differences that you need to work on?
Oh, no, they do converge, but there are, just like any group of people, well, there's 576 enrolled members, federally recognized tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, they have somewhat on sovereignty, they have a monolithic voice, but they are all different. And they are like gradations of a rainbow, John.
Mm-hmm.
They all have their different cultures. They're different traditions, but they are all centered around sovereignty,
mm-hmm.
all centered around the Creator, centered around Mother Earth. There are some basic core values, but they all have their different, based upon, it's like you know this, John, you tell me the landscape you grew up in and I'll tell you who you are. Well, I'm a Great Plains Indian. There are Southwestern Native Americans. There are Eastern Wood Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
There are Coastal Native Americans, all with their own different iteration on life and culture.
So how do you deal with those issues when tribal interests conflict with one another?
It's almost like a, first of all, you listen.
Yeah,
that's the most important thing.
Yeah,
is you listen and you try and find a commonality, a compromise. The words commonality and compromise are words of strength, not words of weakness. It's almost like Sitting Bull, who said, you know, come my brothers and sisters, please let us speak to one another and make a better life for our children.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you do. You identify an issue. You seek to build a coalition, and you seek to find a compromise and a commonality where everyone involved has a voice, has a stake in the outcome,
mm-hmm.
and feel like they have been heard.
Mm-hmm. So is what you do, are you unique as a representative of tribal interests, or are there some other lobbyists in Washington who represent?
Well, I've been called, John, I think kind of an apt description is one time I was called, Tom, you are an acquired taste. I am unique in this sense, John, that I put my native culture and native history first and foremost,
uh-huh.
I would say that. I come from a tribal city, Washington, D.C.
Right.
Tribal not in the sense of indigenous, but tribal in the sense of politics. Even though my values lean towards a more progressive view on life, I believe that my native issues and values come first. At one time, I sued the Secretary of State of Montana, who was a Democrat.
Uh-huh.
But she did not understand and would not support putting polling locations on each reservation in Montana,
uh-huh.
for our Native people who do not have the same access to voting as other people in Montana. You know, John, most people in Montana can walk, you know, can drive across their town or city or walk to a polling location.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the truth. That is not the experience for Native Americans in Montana.
Yeah.
And so I ended up suing the Secretary of State, who was a Democrat, and I had to have conversations with our then Attorney General.
Uh-huh.
And some people said, well, Tom, I thought you were by nature a Democrat. I said, my value system leans that way, but I am first and foremost and will always be Native.
Yeah.
And so in that regard, I've been able to do, John, things that most lobbyists could not do because the architecture of their work environment did not allow it. I work for myself. I decide who I work for.
Uh-huh.
I decide what issue I will work with them on, and I decide how I'm going to work. When I did the Jack Abramoff scandal, if I would have been a member of any law firm or any partnership, I could not have done that.
Uh-huh.
Because I would have exposed my partners and the law firm to liability. But when I saw that Jack Abramoff was taking advantage of Native people, I said this was wrong, and I was never paid for that, John, or should I have been. It was just the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I think we've lost sight of this, John, that we are not the first quality that I always love to cite is empathy, which leads to compassion, which leads to courage, which leads to action.
Uh-huh.
And with Jack's scandal, I saw tribes who were being subject to abject thievery and fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And I said this was wrong, and I sought to do something about it.
I see.
It wasn't about money. It wasn't about glory.
Yeah.
It was about seeing a wrong and trying to make it right. And in this town, in D.C., I had a number of people who said to me, John, well, Tom, why do you care? These tribes aren't paying you any money to help them. And unfortunately, that was the benchmark then and still now,
mm-hmm.
that someone needs to pay you, but you will do the right thing. And so in that regard, I am different, and I owe this to my mother. My mother had amazing empathy and compassion. And she suffered from depression, which disabled her, John, but it allowed me, John, it is my rocket fuel.
So, Tom,
the empathy and compassion she gave me.
So, Tom, who do you lobby or who do you approach most frequently, work with most frequently, members of Congress or the courts or even the administrative offices?
Oh, I would say, John, mostly it is the Congress, mostly the Senate and the House. I am a former Senate staffer. But any issue I work on, John, is a campaign. It's people have a kind of a antiquated view of what a lobbyist or advocate does. They think, oh, he just goes to the Hill and speaks to a congressman and senator and asks for things. It's much more involved than that. You have to have organized ideas. You have to have an organized votes, and you got to have organized money. The three currencies in this country: ideas, money, and votes.
Yeah.
You got to utilize the media. You got to. I mean, the three things that are going to save us from this dark period in our lives are attorneys, whistleblowers, and the media. Because for the most part, not all, they speak truth to power.
Right.
And we are in a dark period in our nation's history. And so when I work on an issue, I approach it literally like a campaign. John, I'm going to come at you six different ways. I'm going to research you until I know everything about you as much as you know about yourself. And then I'm going to utilize all that information, and I'm going to find out where you're weak and where you're strong. And it's almost like judo. I'm going to come after you in a myriad of different ways and make you feel like you're in a phone booth with a boxer. And I'll hit you. I'll leak stories on you. I'll use the media to shape the narrative story. I will go to where you grew up. Like when I went after Jack, I researched where he went to school, who his parents were, who his friends were, where he worked, where he brought property, if he ever had any tickets, if he'd ever gotten in trouble with the law.
Uh-huh.
I I wanted to know everything about him, and then I proceeded to find out even more, and then I leaked it to the media, and the reporter who I leaked it to won the Pulitzer Prize. So it for that work, and the documentary that we ended up doing on that scandal ended up winning the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival.
Congratulations.
So your efforts need to incorporate shaping the narrative of the story. Going to the Hill, but you can't go to the Hill until you have an organized idea.
Uh-huh.
And you should have organized votes.
Uh-huh.
You've got to have strength. You cannot simply go up there and say, I want this.
Uh-huh.
You have to bring something to the table. And in a large measure, we also run on money. You have to go out and raise money.
And
because that's also rocket fuel.
Uh-huh.
So you have to come at an issue 20, 30 different ways. And then you'll prevail. But it's not some simplistic notion of Mr. Smith goes to Washington.
One of the issues that has been in the news periodically has been the issue over the Lakota claim for the Black Hills. Is mm-hmm. that an issue you've worked on?
I have not worked on the Lakota claim for the Black Hills, but I'm very well aware of it. Very well aware of it.
So, what's the objective sought by the Lakota?
Well, it's like a chapter in a narrative. It has always been about the land,
uh-huh.
John. John, this country was founded upon a fraudulent claim of manifest destiny.
Right.
That some divine right enabled certain European ancestors to obtain mastery over the land of the continental United States and Canada, and that they would slaughter the indigenous people of this country in order to achieve living space. And where have you heard that before, John, that an indigenous population would have genocide committed against them for living space? We seem to continue to do that throughout history.
Right.
We did that during World War II. Not us, not Americans, but the Third Reich. And so you had European ancestors who sought to, through thievery, steal this land, steal this country, and commit genocide against the indigenous population.
So even though...
And it has always... But it's always been about that land, John. And then you reduce it farther. You go west to the sacred Black Hills for the Great Sioux Nations, which served as sacred burial grounds for their people. They signed a treaty that they felt was fully enforceable with the government. And remember, the U.S. government has never honored any Native American treaty.
Mm-hmm.
Any Native American treaty.
Mm-hmm.
And when gold was found, well, words meant nothing. And as that Lang says, you know, great nations like great men should honor their words. Well, that was not the case. And so people sought to, once again, steal land. Of course, even the Supreme Court in the late 1800s recognized the abject thievery of the land and awarded the Sioux Nations about $102 million. Well, it has grown since then. But once again, the tribes and the indigenous people of this country have always been about cherishing the land, the sacred land. They don't want the money.
Right.
They don't want the currency. They want the land. And so it's just one long extension of manifest destiny, doctrine of discovery, that this land was always supposed to be European land. And this land was taken, and the tribes were never compensated. You have the Homestead Act, John, 270 million acres, the largest land transfer in our nation's history.
Well, there are several towns that are within the area that the Lakota claim, and there's a state park, a national, Mount Rushmore is even located there.
Right.
How would tribes accommodate for the presence of those facilities.
Well, it is. It is. And I say this, John, you should use history to inform you. You shouldn't use it to imprison you. And it is, for the indigenous population, a difficult viewing. You have, of course, you have George Washington, who was one of the founders of this nation, and had, you know, a number of incredible qualities. But he also was known as the town destroyer. He sought to wipe out a number of the Iroquois villages in upstate New York. So he had his own dark path when it comes to indigenous populations. And I never want to judge any individual on one act, one year of their life. You should look at the landscape of their life, the totality of their life. But George Washington had a dark portion of his life when it came to indigenous people. That also applies to Thomas Jefferson and his pursuit of the Louisiana land purchase and what that involved for Native American people. Once again, about the land, taking the land, always, always stealing the land from indigenous people.
I know that.
Teddy Roosevelt said, you know, not every good Indian is a dead Indian. He just said 9 out of 10 are.
I know that one of the things that offends you is the use of the name Custer. It's the name of the state park and the Custer Gallatin Forest and so on. Yeah, you're really offended by the use of that name. Do you oppose having it changed?
Oh, absolutely. It is a. I mean, you go back to, what is it? I think it was about November the 29th, 1868, the Washita River Massacre. 103 people, 103 warriors killed, women and children.
Uh-huh.
And he was proud of it. Proud of it.
Yeah.
He, of course, lost his life when making boastful claims of how he was going to deal with the Sioux Nations and the Northern Cheyenne in a little of the place of greasy grass, or the Little Bighorn. Well, that was, and remember, he was celebrated. His wife, his widowed wife, conducted a massive public relations campaign to resurrect the reputation of his own character and his own military history. He was now even well liked during the Civil War. He was sent out west. He was, even within his own U.S. military, he was not well-liked. He was not a good person. But for us to have – look at this, John. We've got a town in Forsyth, Montana, which is named after the second-in-command at Wounded Knee.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Wounded Knee. We had, like I said, we had a person named Doan named after a mountain in Yellowstone Park. We have Miles City named after General Miles. We have Sheridan, Wyoming, named after General Sheridan. All of these people sought to starve and exterminate the Native American people. And yet we have sought to somehow memorialize, just like we did with the South, with their, you know, this calling to a previous life and the lost cause. And we've gotten rid of Robert E. Lee. And if you ask people in this country, who was the individual who killed more Americans than any individual in United States history, that would be Robert E. Lee.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you have Lee and Stonewall Jackson and all of these horrible names which defended slavery. The two greatest scars in our world, in our life, in this country are genocide of its native people and slavery.
Right.
And I look forward to the day when, as one incredible general said, this country will live out its creed and honor the native people of this land and what was taken from them. I don't argue for reparations. What I argue for is a reckoning. There needs to be a reckoning, an accounting for the past incredible injustice.
Yeah.
And to insult the native people, to have a national forest named after this individual who massacred native people. What an abject failure of our moral souls in this country.
are there any other sites that are parallel to the situation in the Black Hills across the country, even east of the Mississippi, where tribal groups claim or want to reclaim the area?
Well, yeah, you've got, you know, of course, we just had the recent Bears Ears Monument. You have there anywhere there are what you're looking now, like I said, is an outgrowth now of even what we're trying to achieve in and around Yellowstone Park. Yellowstone has always been a, as you know, a crossing point for numerous 49 indigenous populations throughout the United States. But yet, we have always been treated like we are visitors to that park. Has it gotten somewhat better? Yes. But it has not been nearly enough. And I don't fault in any way the current superintendent, Cam Shawley. He has been wonderful. I like Cam. But there are other economic interests in and around there that this land should not be a theme park, and it should not be a recreation park.
Mm-hmm.
It should be a sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And across the country, what happened here, John, is our ancestors, and I want you to know this, John. People say to you, well, Tom, how can you judge me because of my ancestors? I said, well, yes, they lived in a different time, but I would like to think that even if you lived in that time, you had enough moral clarity that you knew it was wrong to own another man or woman or to kill them for their land.
Hey, Tom, we're okay. Running low on time. I just wanted to ask you before we conclude this session what difference it has made to have Deb Haaland as the Secretary of Interior.
Oh, yeah. Well, it is nice. There's no doubt about that, John, that we have a situation now where we have, first of all, a woman, which is wonderful. There's far too much testosterone in this world. And number two, an indigenous woman who can convey a sense of community, of compassion, of a celebration of what Mother Earth is about, and the fact that she is native. When you think of the, once again, when you think of the Department of Interior, you think of land and water and air, and a healing aspect of that. And so it is long past due, but it is welcome. And so we celebrate that fact, John.
That's great. Well, Tom, we have to wrap it up, but I really appreciate talking with you. Let's do another interview, and we'll continue this conversation. But we have to
have a one place, John.
We have to conclude for today. Our guest today has been Tom Rogers, a Native American activist. He's an advocate for tribal issues in Washington, D.C. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.com or buzzsprout.com. Additional features on our website are at js-wilderness.com. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.